song about a bunch of guys and women who are inspired by the Bible. In the 1640s, they were inspired by the Bible to chop off the head of the King of England. In 1649, St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlord and defied the law. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. Come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make the waste ground grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it shall be a common treasury for all. The sin of property, we do disdain. No man has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder, they took the land. Now everywhere the walls rise up at their command. They made the laws to chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feels the rich while poor folks starve. We work, we eat together, we need no sword. We will not bow to the masters or pay rent to the Lord. Still we are free, though we are poor. Diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. Yeah. From the men of property, the orders came. They sent the hired men and traverse to wipe out the diggers' claim. Tear down their cottages and destroy their corn. They were dispersed, but still the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. In peace, the orders came to cut them down. We come in peace, the orders came to cut them down. Amanda Palmer, ladies and gentlemen.
And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin Annie, Eagle Strong Voice. That's the vision, folks. The world in common, as it was given to us by the Creator. Now, that movement is quite incredible. It was the Diggers movement. It came out of England in the 1640s, which was the same time that the King of England's head was chopped off. The Republic of England was declared in 1649 by Parliament, and that precedent is what we stand on, one of the precedents we stand on, in declaring the Republic in Canada, or Canada, as some people call it. And we're going to be talking about that today. Today is going to be a continuation of, I guess you could call it the teach-in. It's a dialogue, really, between me and you and between our movement and the wider world. I used to do these dialogue sermons from the pulpit in Port Alberni, which, of course, got me in trouble with certain people because the voices that were suppressed could finally be heard. And this is what we want to do on the show today, like on all our shows here at on BBS Radio, Here We Stand. We are putting out ideas and wanting to hear back from you. So when you hear things talked about today, write it down, jot down questions, comments, whatever. Write to us, Republic of Canada, K-A-N-A-T-A, Republic of Canada at gmail.com, and do background reading at murderbydecree.com. One of the other precedents on our work is based is the fact that this country is founded on genocide and mass murder, and we're never going to get clean of that unless we have a whole new deal altogether. One of the questions that came in this last week was, well, how are you guys different than a lot of the other movements that are springing up, as they should, all over the country, all over the world, talking about sovereignty? And, you know, there's things like Wexit, the Western Exit movement in Western Canada. There's Unify the People. There's other groups that are, in their own way, raising the same things we do. But here's what's unique about the Republic of Kanata movement. First of all, it's thinking and acting outside the box. We're not trying to tinker with the system. We're not trying to get changes and operating according to the standards and the terms of the present system. We're creating a grassroots republic, and that means the second aspect, we create it from the grassroots up. We form sovereignty cells of three or more people. Based on that, we form common law assemblies, and those are the people who hammer out the Constitution, who take back power in their own communities through common law courts, common law sheriffs. There's now 43 of these groups working across Canada, 29 in the east, 14 in the west, and that's an increase of 7 in the last week, folks. We're going to talk a little bit about today. And, you know, I've been meeting these groups systematically over the last number of months, and it's very exciting on the ground to see how people are really coming, you know, in the 100th monkey system of suddenly the ideas spread everywhere, spontaneously coming up like grass all over the country. And that's the reality of what's going on in the collective unconscious here. So today we're going to do some basics. We're going to answer some of the questions you've had from last week when I had a kind of a fireside chat going over different things. And one of those first things I want to answer, because a number of you wrote about this, they said, talk a little bit about Magna Carta. How is this document from 1215 going to help us? And I'm going to get into that, but I want to remind you, too, that once again at the midpoint today, we're going to have our good friend George Carlin back on, a little comic relief, to talk about a very important thing, and that is how words are misused, how he hates euphemisms. Well, hated, he's passed on or died, as he would say. Let's not mince our words. Let's talk about life and death. But when he was here on this planet, George would often go on about the hypocrisy, how language is used to deceive us. And he's going to talk a bit about that today when I take a break and he can talk. But as for the first thing about the common law and Magna Carta, this keeps coming up. And let me just remind folks, Magna Carta is a Latin word. It means great charter. And this was something that the barons of England literally held a knife to the throat of King John in the year 1215 and said, you're going to sign this, because for the first time in history, it limited the power of a monarch, whether it be a pope or a king or anybody else who thought that they ruled by what they thought was divine right. And this great charter really laid the basis for a lot of the things that in common law we take for granted. For example, one of the points is, no one shall be seized or imprisoned or stripped of their rights or outlawed or exiled except by the lawful judgment of his equals or by the law of the land. In other words, some king can't just order your arrest. Well, it's interesting how that's thrown out these days. And that's actually an item I wanted to flag as well to think about today. It's in the news. There's a bill before the British Columbia legislature called Bill 19. Let me just flag that before we get into the Magna Carta discussion, because it's very relevant. Bill 19 is called, the official title is 2020 COVID-19 Related Measures Act. And if you look down, scroll down to part four, it says that basically no public official can be held liable for anything they do. You cannot sue anyone in public office. The way they have it is no legal proceeding for prescribed damages related to the COVID-19, quote, pandemic may be commenced or maintained against a person or prescribed person for any act or omission. So in legalese, what's that saying is anything a politician or a bureaucrat, like say the health minister, says or does, cannot be sued for it. It's like Big Pharma. They brought in these laws back in the 80s. Reagan and other presidents brought in these laws protecting Big Pharma from ever getting sued or being liable for anything. Well, the politicians that serve these Big Pharma interests are now doing the same thing. And also it's retroactive, which means anything they've ever said or done cannot be the subject of a lawsuit. You know, this retroactive thing, which is, again, very illegal for them to do. And also it gives the lieutenant governor in BC state of emergency powers. This one guy can tell you that you don't have any rights anymore. Well, screw that. Of course, that has no basis in Magna Carta or common law. One of the things you should look at, and you can look at Magna Carta, it's right at the back in one of the appendices of our book, Establishing the Reign of Natural Liberty, a Common Law Training Manual. This book is a real popular item. You can get it on Amazon under Kevin Annett. Get it from me right to thecommonland@gmail.com, and we'll send you copies. And What it says in section 61 at the back is there's a provision put in whereby in order to enforce Magna Carta, a group of 25 barons can get together and basically seize crown property. Anything except the life and person of the king and his family, they can seize any land owned by the crown to compensate them for any damages done to them by the crown. Well, folks, this means under Magna Carta, we can seize crown land, which is all of Canada, according to their laws. So, you know, Magna Carta has great power and ability to help us in our everyday life. And the thing is, it uses language about barons. All that meant is the signatories. That applies to anyone. Any citizen can invoke this. And so anyway, that's one example of how Magna Carta can help us right now, because it is something not known by a lot of native groups. You know, they have the basis even under the law of the dominating culture to seize the land for reparations because of damages done by the crown and their church partners, for example, in wiping out 60,000 children in the Indian residential schools for which no person has ever gone to trial, let alone jail. So this is an example of how Magna Carta can serve us. One example. Now, I wanted to read to you something, and it's it gives you kind of an idea of why these things can be gotten away with. And it's from a conversation I had. It's taken from my book, The Border, and I call it Freud Was Right, Conversations with a Killer at Peace with Himself. And I start with a quote from Sigmund Freud where he says, civilization arises through the suppression of the base instinct of aggression, generating in mankind a neurosis that's barely masked by so-called ethical values. And here's the key statement. It's possible to bind together a considerable number of people in love so long as there are other people left over to receive the manifestations of their aggressiveness. In other words, you can be a killer but also love your kids. You know, because your kids, hopefully, are within your own circle of protection, but people outside are not worthy of the same standards, so you can kill them. And I had a grotesque example of this early on in this campaign when I was involved in exposing the residential school genocide. It happened 24 years ago this month. It was June 1996. I got a call from a guy who used to work at the St. George's Anglican Residential School in Lytton, British Columbia. And he said he wanted to talk to me. Let me just read the account here. The man acted very pleasant, as they always do. He even picked up the tab for the tea and donuts we had shared and seemed genuinely concerned about my recent divorce and the distress it was likely causing to my young daughters. He was, after all, an expert on children. I hadn't known what to expect that day. It was early in my sojourn into a bizarre world that dwelled alongside the tatters of the life I'd known, and I was still very raw and naive. I politely allowed the stranger to explain why he had worked for so long at the death camp known as the St. George's Anglican Indian Residential School in Lytton, B.C., for he had been the one to ask to see me after my name had hit the headlines. Normally the kids could play outdoors, under supervision, of course, he said, but there were always the ne'er-do-wells who tried to run away. The elderly man stared at me matter-of-factly. He was well into his description of life at the Lytton School. Well, what happened to those kids, I asked him. The first offense, they got a week on bread and water. After that, punishment got more severe. Well, how severe? He seemed to weigh his words. There were some stocks in the corner of the playground, and they were used, rain or shine. You locked children into stocks, like out of the Middle Ages, that kind? Well, of course, it was the prescribed punishment for felons, he said curtly. Prescribed, I said. But how could they be felons? They were only children. The man smiled at me condescendingly. You obviously haven't read up on the legislation, he replied. His eyes bore into me. And just a note on that, the legislation in the Indian Act allowed any child who, even if you're 5 years old, who ran away to be immediately declared as a felon and could be put in prison with adults. That's where Indians ranked in the same scheme of things and where they still rank under the Indian Act. But back to the story. So I continued, after jotting down notes on that napkin, I said, well, what else happened besides these stocks? And he replied, manacles, occasional floggings of the older boys, the ringleaders. Well, but what happened they brought upon themselves. I stared at him as the cafe radio told me I deserved a trip to sunny Mexico. Well, what did happen? I asked him. There were some deaths, he said, after a pause. Then he shook his head. No, strike that. That's an old habit. There were a lot of deaths. Too many, really. In my early years, right after the war, we were burying kids two or three to a grave out behind the garbage dump. The staff had improved the disposal methods by the 1960s. How had they improved them, I asked. You don't want to know, he answered. Well, what did they die of, those children? His eyes looked cautious for the first time, and I thought I wasn't going to answer. Then he sighed and sipped his tea as if trying to hold me in suspense. Finally, he said, the official story was acts of nature, disease, but that was malarkey. We often just let them starve to death. But the preferred method was to lock them in together, the healthy with the sick, and never treat any of them. That way, the TB took away most of them. So-called natural causes, you see. Neat and tidy. Well, it was the most un-Canadian moment when a witness and participant admitted that mass murder of children was deliberately executed by Christian staff members in an Indian school as recently as 1996, just the same year I interviewed him. That's the year the last school closed. I must have looked confused because the old man smiled again, but his look made me angry. Nobody objected, I declared. Object, he replied. Who would object? It was all government approved. It was all legal. Well, to hell with legality, I said. How can you just sit there and admit to all of this? How could you be part of this? He glanced around at the near-empty cafe, and then he leaned towards me and said, I can admit anything I want to you, my young friend, because no one's ever going to believe it. They'll think you're crazy if you talk of this. I suggest you reflect on that. Well, I realized in a flash that, like the United Church officials who were involved in gutting my life, at the same moment, the aging Anglican across me thought he was God and quite untouchable. And accordingly, I could get him to disclose anything, even if I'd have no proof afterwards of what he'd admitted. So I sucked in my outrage and I continued, I hear every school had a punishment log. Did you guys have one? Well, naturally we did, he said. It was a regulation. Days, times, offenses, all the measures we meted out, plus the special treatment, of course. What were those? Special cases, the hardcore rebels, those kids tagged for the Indian hospitals at the DRB labs. What's the DRB? Defense Research Board in Ottawa. A national security matter, you know. Lots of money involved. Very hush-hush. What about the Indian hospitals? Well, he said matter-of-factly, sterilizations, experimental surgeries, drug testing, usual gamut. It was common procedure in those places. It wasn't just us either. The United Church was in on it, and the Catholics had their own operations. Nobody ever talks about them, though. Too strange and cultic for my taste. Well, it went on like that until I couldn't stomach any more of it, especially after he described how as punishment children were routinely tied to the backs of cars and made to run along or be dragged after it, or held down as their teeth were yanked out with painkillers, or subjected to a regime of mandatory rape upon entering the school. It isn't an easy thing to understand what we had to do, he said after a silence. You had to do it, I said, and don't think it didn't bother me for a while. But that's all in the past now. And you can sleep at nights? Of course. Why wouldn't I? He said calmly. I'm a deacon in our church and a life skills counselor. I have 5 grandchildren. I'm a very happy and contented man. But I said, how can you be? How can any of you be? He paused and smiled the kind of self-assuredness that abounds on church Sundays. Because we know that God forgives us. Now, the reason I read that is because it's not only the attitude still in these churches that committed and funded these crimes, that's the attitude of Canadians when you talk about the real history of this country. And that's why we've had to make a break to say, look, forget about COVID. This is just the same manifestation of what's been going on over a century. You want to know about mandatory vaccinations? Just go on an Indian reservation. Under the Indian Act, ever since 1874, you cannot refuse medical treatment. They can come on to any reservation and shove a needle in the arm of any kid they like. If the parent refuses, they're in jail for 5 years. That's been the way for a century and a half in Canada, but we are all outraged now that it's happening to all of us. The point is, folks, if we don't learn about the genocide against others, it happens to us too. And on that note, I was going to share something with you, but it's kind of repetitive. I want to move on to something else. But there's another thing I would urge you to read, and people might say, well, where's a native leadership on this? The point is there is no native leadership. In my book, I go into the details of how at a special meeting right after I was fired in April 1996, just a few months before I met that Anglican, actually, there was a meeting between the top leadership of the West Coast Tribal Council, the New Chalmers Tribal Council, and Virginia Coleman and Marion Best, the top leaders of the United Church, the same two women who had actually arranged my firing and defrocking after I began to expose this. And they made a deal. They made an offer to the chiefs that they would give them money for personal injury lawsuit settlements, as subsequently happened, only on two conditions. If they never talked about murdered children or dead children in a residential school, and if they had nothing to do with me and our movement to expose these genocidal crimes, the chiefs went along with it. And ever since then, not one government-funded Native chief has dared to talk about mass graves of children or any of that until the government co-opted the issue and it became safe to kind of lamely address the issue without ever laying charges or saying who is to blame. So the reality is, in Canada, when we're talking about a republic, you've got that at every level of society. You've got an arrangement whereby all roads lead to, well, not just Rome and London, but the Privy Council Office, which is the body that runs the country. Every member of parliament, every cop, civil servant, they all take an oath of allegiance to the crown, so-called this fictitious crown. And you can't work in that system, as we tried to get genocide adjudicated in the courts in Canada. It was thrown out every time because the crown-appointed judges are not going to implicate the crown or the Vatican in these crimes. So that's why we went outside the country. That's why we set up the common law court, and it worked. We forced Ratzinger and others out of office. We've even forced the Crown of England to step down, and this is why this outbreak is happening all over the world. People see that it works. People can take the power into their own hands, and that's kind of a, you know, lesson that shouldn't be lost on any of us. Now, to get down to kind of the practical aspect of what we do, there, like I said, there's 43 groups across the country now actively organizing common law assemblies, and there's two things to remember. First of all, rights only exist when they're practiced, and battles are won or lost before they're ever fought, depending on who controls the energy of the situation, or what Sun Tzu in the Art of War calls the chi. Now, I want to talk briefly about those two. We are never given rights at all. They're born in us, but they only come into existence by practicing them. And the second part flows from that, because when we start practicing them, we go into immediate conflict with the system. And there was an example of that. I mentioned Bill 19, where they're about to put themselves beyond the reach of the law, which is kind of a admission of guilt when they realize that, there's even worse stuff coming down, so they want to protect themselves from being sued. But once you start challenging that, you realize that any right that you practice that challenges their agenda is immediately ruled a crime. And we enter into battle, but we can arrange the terrain of battle so we are defining the narrative. We are defining what the issue is, and that gives us tremendous power. We did that in the battle in Canada. We defined the issue from the start as genocide, not sexual abuse. Just like today, we are defining the issue as a police state, not a COVID virus, because we know the whole thing about a virus is bogus. I've yet to meet anybody who's got one, who's even sick from it. And so define the terrain of battle, and the advantage is on your side, regardless of your numbers. And that's, a really important thing to keep in mind. And that's why at the back of both our manual for whistleblowers, the Truth Teller Shield, and the Common Law Training Manual, we've reprinted some of the most important parts of Sun Tzu, The Art of War. Now, we've got about 5 minutes before George Carlin comes on. So I wanted to just answer another one of the questions that you guys had coming out of last week. And that is, go into more detail. We ran out of time last week, and I was reading from the part in the common law, the whistleblower manual, about how we deal with the smear campaigns, what I call the three D's, which is what they employ against you when you start entering into battle. They deny, they distract, and they discredit. They deny the crime you're bringing out. They distract from it by talking about other stuff, and they try to discredit you immediately. So I'm going to get into that after George Carlin, because it kind of flows naturally out of the discussion of that he has about the nature of language and how it's used to control all of us. And he's got some really good examples. I'll let him do the talking on that. But another thing I want to talk about in the second half of the show is a really amazing thing I discovered. It was in the course of writing a book called The Sacrifice. It was about the death of my uncle Bob. He's my father, Bill. 91-year-old father down there in Florida. Hi, Dad. His eldest brother, Bob, was killed during World War II. He was a sub-lieutenant on a Canadian destroyer, the Athabascan. He was a gunnery officer at age 19. And the Athabascan was torpedoed in the English Channel April 29th, 1944. Bob was in the water with 100 guys. The British Navy, who was responsible for rescuing them, called off the rescue mission. They told all ships to avoid these guys in the water. It turns out, from examination into the story more, Bob's ship was sunk by friendly fire. There were no German E-boats around there. They had all been driven off, and the German destroyers, they had sunk in a running gun battle. They were sunk by a British mortar torpedo boat. And then to cover that up, the Admiralty left those guys to drown in the water, including my Uncle Bob and 100 other men from the Athabascan. They're all buried in Brittany. I've gone to the grave and seen it. And, brought some of the soil of Uncle Bob back to Consort, Alberta, where my family's from. But the amazing thing is that as I looked into that, there was a whole history in the British Empire. Right after World War II, they scrubbed all of the records of anywhere in the British Empire where there had been genocide, where there had been atrocity, war crimes, where they had killed people by friendly fire, like they did to Michael Bob and 100 other crewmen. And they scrubbed it out. And there's an account, even in the Guardian newspaper in England, they did a series on this 5 years ago, showing how all of the imperial records from the colonies, including from Canada, were scrubbed clean and false records were put in there to give kind of a positive spin on the history of the British Empire. So the whole bogus investigation into the Canadian residential schools done by the Crown, done by the Canadian government, called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is a complete farce. And I'll talk about that after for those of you who don't know about that. But it was an amazing miscarriage and obstruction of justice. But they were simply following colonial policy. By any official record in Canada, whether it's about residential schools or anything that happened, have all been scrubbed clean of any reference to genocide. And I discovered that early on in the Kerner Library, the University of British Columbia, where I found all of their first records on the residential schools. In the correspondence, there'd be a big gap of like 6 weeks. There'd be a mention of the death of a child and then nothing. So clearly the records had been censored. But this was coming out of not just some bureaucrat in Ottawa, but from a dictate from the colonial office in London to every part of the British Empire to scrub those records clean. That's why we're getting a false version of events and why we have to rely on our own records. And again, if you read murderbydecree.com, that was written as a counter report to the bogus TRC report, which they were ordered not to mention ever, never take down as evidence the reference to a dead child when over 60,000 of them were killed deliberately by the Catholic, Anglican, United Churches. So I'm going to get into how history and language is rewritten, but leading into that, we're going to hear from George Carlin right now. Thank you.
I don't like words that hide the truth. I don't like words that conceal reality. I don't like euphemisms or euphemistic language. And American English is loaded with euphemisms because Americans have a lot of trouble dealing with reality. Americans have trouble facing the truth. So they invent a kind of a soft language to protect themselves from it. And it gets worse with every generation. For some reason, it just keeps getting worse. I'll give you an example of that. There's a condition in combat. Most people know about it. It's when a fighting person's nervous system has been stressed to its absolute peak and maximum, can't take any more input. The nervous system has either snapped or is about to snap. In the First World War, that condition was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language. Two syllables, shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was 70 years ago. Then a whole generation went by, and the Second World War came along, and the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now. Takes a little longer to say. Doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had the war in Korea, 1950. Madison Avenue was riding high by that time, and the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. Hey, we're up to 8 syllables now. And the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's totally sterile now. Operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car. Then, of course, came the war in Vietnam, which has only been over for about 16 or 17 years. And thanks to the lies and deceit surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you, if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you that. I'll bet you that. Yeah. But it didn't happen. And one of the reasons is because we were using that soft language. That language that takes the life out of life. And it is a function of time. It does keep getting worse. Give you another example. Sometime during my life, toilet paper became bathroom tissue. I wasn't notified of this. No one asked me if I agreed with it. It just happened. Toilet paper became bathroom tissue. Sneakers became running shoes. False teeth became dental appliances. Medicine became medication. Information became directory assistance. The dump became the landfill. Car crashes became automobile accidents. Partly cloudy became partly sunny. Motels became motor lodges. House trailers became mobile homes. Used cars became previously owned transportation. Room service became guest room dining. And constipation became occasional irregularity. When I was a little kid, if I got sick, they wanted me to go to the hospital and see the doctor. Now they want me to go to a health maintenance organization or a wellness center to consult a healthcare delivery professional. Poor people used to live in slums. Now the economically disadvantaged occupy substandard housing in the inner cities. And they're broke. They're broke. They don't have a negative cash flow position. They're fucking broke. Because a lot of them were fired. You know, fired. Management wanted to curtail redundancies in the human resources area. So many people are no longer viable members of the workforce. Smug, greedy, well-fed white people have invented a language to conceal their sins. It's as simple as that. The CIA doesn't kill anybody anymore. They neutralize people. Or they depopulate the area. The government doesn't lie and engages in disinformation. The Pentagon actually measures nuclear radiation in something they call sunshine units. Israeli murderers are called commandos. Arab commandos are called terrorists. Contra killers are called freedom fighters. Well, if crime fighters fight crime and firefighters fight fire, what do freedom fighters fight? They never mention that part of it to us, do they? Never mention that part of it. And some of this stuff is just silly. We all know that. Like on the airlines, they say they want a pre-board. Well, what the hell is pre-board? What does that mean? To get on before you get on? They say they're going to pre-board those passengers in need of special assistance. Cripples! Simple, honest, direct language. There's no shame attached to the word cripple that I can find in any dictionary. No shame attached to it. In fact, it's a word used in Bible translations. Jesus healed the cripples. Doesn't take seven words to describe that condition. But we don't have any cripples in this country anymore. We have the physically challenged. Is that a grotesque enough evasion for you? How about differently abled? I've heard them called that, differently abled. You can't even call these people handicapped anymore. They'll say, we're not handicapped, we're handicapable. These poor people have been bullshitted by the system into believing that if you change the name of the condition, somehow you'll change the condition. Well, hey, cousin, doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. We have no more deaf people in this country, hearing impaired. No one's blind anymore, partially sighted or visually impaired. We have no more stupid people. Everybody has a learning disorder. Or he's minimally exceptional. How would you like to be told that about your child? He's minimally exceptional. Oh, thank God for that. Psychologists actually have started calling ugly people those with severe appearance deficits. It's getting so bad that any day now I expect to hear a rape victim referred to as an unwilling sperm recipient. And we have no more old people in this country. No more old people. We shipped them all away, and we brought in these senior citizens. Isn't that a typically American 20th century phrase? Bloodless, lifeless. No pulse in one of them. A senior citizen. But I've accepted that one. I've come to terms with it. I know it's here to stay. We'll never get rid of it. That's what they're going to be called, so I'll relax on that. But the one I do resist, the one I keep resisting, is when they look at an old guy and they'll say, "Look at him, Dan. He's 90 years young." Imagine the fear of aging that reveals. To not even be able to use the word old to describe someone, to have to use an antonym. And fear of aging is natural, it's universal, isn't it? We all have that. No one wants to get old, no one wants to die, but we do. So we bullshit ourselves. I started bullshitting myself when I got to my 40s. Soon as I was in my 40s, I'd look in the mirror and I'd say, "Well, I guess I'm getting older." Older sounds a little better than old, doesn't it? Sounds like it might even last a little longer. Bullshit, I'm getting old. And it's okay, because thanks to our fear of death in this country, I won't have to die. I'll pass away. Or I'll expire like a magazine subscription. If it happens in the hospital, they'll call it a terminal episode. The insurance company will refer to it as negative patient care outcome. And if it's the result of malpractice, they'll say it was a therapeutic misadventure. I'm telling you, some of this language makes me want to vomit. Well, maybe not vomit. Makes me want to engage in an involuntary personal protein spill. Thank you all.
And we're back. George Carlin, I love you. You know, he's saying things that are just common sense and true, but you know what I find amazing? Canadians are even more that way. Like, he always goes after his own countrymen and women, of course. And Canada tends to be invisible to Yanks, I know. But Canada, it's even more that way. And his expression, pain buried under jargon, I lived that for 25 years, bringing out, you know, the truth of this pain, the people's pain. This whole term abuse and healing, these are like words created by the dominant culture to hide the fact that it was mass murder, rape, torture, genocide, mass graves. I mean, you know, you listen to the stories of people and all those things are happening, but they never use the word torture in the mainstream. In the Canadian newspaper, I challenge you to look at any media account of residential schools going back to 1996 when he first began to bring this out. And the word murder, torture, killing is never in there. It's abuse. It's a generic term introduced by actually a native puppet called Phil Fontaine. He was head of the Assembly of First Nations, that puppet organization. He stood up in 1990 and introduced the word abuse. He said, "I was abused in the residential school." Well, abuse can be anything from using harsh language to someone to anything. It's deliberately nebulous, like George is talking about. And in that regard, I want to, somebody sent me a message just now, finish off on Bill 19. What should we do about it? Remember Bill 19, whereby the government is now immunizing themselves against any lawsuits for anything related to what they do or don't do around COVID, the bogus virus. And yes, you cannot, some people are talking about taking them to court to stop this. You cannot use the Crown Courts. They're immune within their own system of power. It'll just be thrown out, as has happened every other time we've tried anything like this. You've got to create a common law court and issue what's called a notice of liability, saying, I'm holding you personally liable, every one of you, for any damage or neglect that happens as a result of what you're doing. If they don't respond, you issue them a default notice, and at that point, you can get an order from the common law court to seize their assets, to put a lien on their accounts, to even perform citizen arrests on them. And that's where our groundwork comes in. We need the common law sheriffs and community-based courts to make that happen. That's what we're actively organizing now. So that's our response, what Bill 19 should be, our response to Bill 19 should be. And in the meantime, ignore it. It has no standing. It's a few people doing this. These so-called laws are statutes that have no basis in fact or the law, so ignore them. Now, going on with George Carlin, the whole point about language, a few things to throw out how language right now is being used to keep us dumb. Take the most common one, which I like to use, and that is, you heard a lot about apology. That's something that Canadians love. They love to talk about apology. Well, the word, I challenge you to look it up in the Oxford English Dictionary. You'll see no mention of I'm sorry or expression of regret. It's not what the word apology means. Apologia in both Greek and Roman means to defend one's actions or words or the actions or words of another. So when a government gets up, like when Stephen Harper apologized for the residential school, what he was saying was he was defending the actions of the government and the churches and the residential schools and thereby legally indemnifying themselves. He was saying we didn't do anything wrong. And proof of that is in any settlement money going to Indian survivors, they had to sign a statement absolving the churches and government of any legal liability. So when the government says, I apologize, they don't say I'm sorry, they say apology. They're really saying we're justified in what we did. And yet everybody's hearing it as, oh, isn't it nice, they're sorry for what they did. So that's an example of the doublethink, where, you know, white is black and black is white. And we've got a whole list of these, actually. There's a thing we put out called Language is Power, the meaning of key words. Here's another one, name. From the Hebrew word nomos, which was a plaque that you hung on a slave to say who owned them. Name is a name given to you by the system when you're registered at birth or by your parents, but that is your slave designation. Don't forget in the Bible, God says, I have no name, I am that I am. That's what you say if a police stops you and asks for your name. You just say, well, I am. I'm a man, I'm a woman. That's all you have to say to them. And then you aren't entering their jurisdiction and they have no authority over you. It's these names and these hooks whereby they catch you in the system, but you don't realize you're being caught because you've been conditioned to think that that's just normal. Yes, so in our last 15 minutes or 10 minutes here, I want to just finish off on a few things. I mentioned about that case involving my uncle. This is fully described in a book called The Sacrifice. Again, you can get it on Amazon under my name. And it's a chapter entitled Sanitizing the Crimes, the Empire's Post-War Spin. Let me just summarize what these Guardian articles found out. In 2011, a group of Kenyans sued the British government for the torture they'd suffered when they were Mau Mau rebels during Kenya's fight for independence in the 1950s. The British Foreign Office was ordered to release 8,800 files from 37 former colonies, including Canada, from their center at Hounslow Park in Buckinghamshire. Lo and behold, the files revealed a cornucopia of damning evidence, not only concerning the systematic torture and murder of colonial people by the British Crown and its army, but about the institutionalized cover-up of these crimes and the spinning of British colonial history. Now, to quote the Guardian article from 2012 that broke the story, among the documents are a handful which show that many of the most sensitive papers from Britain's late colonial era were not hidden away, but simply destroyed. These papers give us instructions for systematic destruction issued in 1961 after Ian MacLeod, Secretary of State for the Colonies, directed the post-independence government should not get any material that might embarrass Her Majesty's government or former members of the military or police or civil servants. The documents that were either destroyed outright or those that were not destroyed appear to be kept secret and a dummy file was created in their place called the Legacy Files. And these legacy files consisted of false information. So, for example, about an Indian residential school, they'd insert a file showing, well, no, it wasn't 50% death rate, which is what Dr. Peter Bryce and the other doctors reported from their own investigations. No, it was more like 2 or 3%. And so, of course, naturally, when the government's Truth and Reconciliation Commission comes along, they say 2 or 3% because they're quoting from these doctored colonial files. And in some cases, documents were totally purged. And it's interesting because when I first began to look in the documents in Kerner Library at the UBC Library, in the residential school archives, it said often you'd come across a document and would say this material has been removed according to the Federal Cabinet Directive number 46 of June 7th, 1973. It turns out that Cabinet Directive was referring to the colonial order coming out in 1946 to destroy any compromised documents. So, in other words, people, if you go through the official records, you're always going to get a doctored account. And that's true whether you work through the courts or the government or whatever. The system of information is totally controlled, just like the internet is. You see on the internet or on Facebook or whatever what you're allowed to see. You find the truth in real life through your life experience. And this is what we're saying in all these meetings we're holding on the common law assemblies. Your experience is your best teacher. You know the truth not because of what you've seen on the internet, not because of what you've heard is going on. You know, what Trudeau's doing or Trump's doing, you know, all these innuendo and rumor, that's secondhand, thirdhand. What you know is from your own experience, and you have to base reality on that. And by your ingrown knowledge of what's right and wrong, that's really the basis of a lot of what we do. And contrarily, in order to counter our work, that's why these smear campaigns come along, because they insert, well, lies. We won't call them misinformation, according to George Carlin, right? It's not misinformation. It's too vague a term. It's a lie. They introduce lies when we know the truth. And one of the ways we counter that is by simply going back to the hard evidence. When people start attacking you and disrupting you with false information, and it's going to come, those of you who are moving past just talking into actually taking direct action on things, you're going to immediately be met by infiltrators and people who come in and start, often through the internet, they start circulating rumors about your best activists. Oh, did you know Kevin has made Native women pregnant on all these reservations? That's something that came out early on. And I remember saying to somebody, you know, telling a man in his late 50s he's made all these women pregnant it does things to one's ego, you know, when you're in your late 50s to hear that. So I would kind of joke about these things. But the point is, they use things that are going to get people very upset about them. And I saw a classic example of this. There was a movement in the downtown east side of Vancouver to bring groups together to fight the eviction of people. And it was a really incredible meeting. There was over 200 people at it. Suddenly, in the middle of this meeting, a Native woman called Kelly White gets up, and she's a known government infiltrator. She gets up and she starts screaming that the chair of the meeting, the most effective organizer, had raped her children. And the meeting fell apart, you know, in confusion. People didn't know, well, I can't support this guy if he's a rapist, but how do we know? It totally busted apart the meeting and the group. The whole coalition fell apart. And then Kelly walked away with a smile on her face. Obviously, her kids hadn't been harmed, but she put that out there to discredit the person. And the person never showed up again. They had shamed him out of the meeting, but everyone believed the lie. And that's how it works. You tell the biggest lie possible. That's what Hitler said in Mein Kampf. The people do not think by and large. They react emotionally. And so you have to tell as big a lie as possible for them to believe it. And so the way we counter lies is by evidence. You don't respond by attacking somebody in turn or start name calling or acting defensive. You just stand on the evidence and say, you know, I remember I met with Noam Chomsky once in Boston. And I said to him, well, you know, during the 60s, they were smearing you a lot. I remember, you know, there were rumors about you sleeping with your grad students. And he said, oh, yeah, the FBI planted all these rumors about me in the peace movement to get people to turn away. And I said, well, how'd you deal with that? And he said, well, I just would say to the reporter, show me the evidence. And evidence isn't rumor. It isn't, you know, oh, I hear this about Kevin or I hear this about Noam Chomsky. No, it's a document that can be tested to in court. It's somebody, a live eyewitness, right, who sees something. And every time you say, show me the evidence, your critics fall right away because none of the smears are based on anything real. They're not based on hard evidence. It's always just innuendo designed to trigger people's fears. So you kind of got to laugh it off the way I do when I joke about, you know, the sexual ability of a man in his late 50s or whatever. You know, I mean, come on, people. These are ridiculous things designed to distract. And the good thing about a smear campaign is that over the long run, it helps you because it's designed to take somebody out immediately. And if it doesn't work, you might have noticed that on the YouTube and other things, all these smears that used to touch my name, they're gone now. They don't really happen anymore because they realize the more you talk about somebody, the more attention you bring to them, and they don't want to do that. I remember when the churches were approached by the reporters and said, how do you respond to these charges by Kevin Annett? They'd say no comment because they knew it was true, the massive deaths that they caused, and the truth was on my side. They just didn't want to give me credibility by responding. Just like when you put these criminals on trial and they don't respond to the charges, it's an admission of guilt on their part. And that's a tremendous weapon we have. Okay, so I felt I had to say that. I was responding to a couple of the questions coming out of our common law groups about smear campaigns and how we deal with them. Because as soon as you form a group, it's important to form a solid core group first. Do not bring in outsiders. Do not bring in anyone you don't know. Solidify your perspectives and your common vision and your plan of action together, and then move out. And operate according to a cell structure, so you can have groups of three or four or five people operating. Big organizations get infiltrated and wiped out very quickly. Trust me, it's happened to me three times. And we know how they operate. And that's another important thing Sun Tzu says. Your adversary is bigger than you, and so they're less flexible. They don't know how to respond to unpredictable actions on your part. They've only got set protocols because they're a big corporation and they can't respond to your initiatives. So you always have to outflank them and outthink them. Do the unpredictable. Never do what they expect you to do. Always do the unpredictable. And that's, you know, is true in anything we do. And especially now, because what we're doing is we're stepping outside the system. And just closing words on that, we're tempted, because of the way we've all been mentally conditioned, to always swing back into the rut that we've thought in for our whole life. And that is, you've got to look for something in the system, in not even what in the system, but what's familiar to us in the language or in our assumptions. We have to question our assumptions because we carry inside our head a policeman. It's being crafted by the system. We censor ourselves all the time from saying what's true because it might offend somebody or it might get us in trouble. But we have to be in the company of those who aren't afraid to speak and act. And you have to form an alternative community and go to that community. That's why these common law assemblies can't just meet whenever we like it. They've got to meet every week, same time, same place, so that people are on the same page. And you can come back like you're doing on the show. You're hearing things. You're writing back to me. It's a dialogue. It's a give and take situation. That's what a living movement does. Not an organization, but an organism. We keep growing and evolving through this dialogue, and you go out and you act, and then you bring back your experience and say, let's talk about it. What worked? What didn't work? That's what we do all the time in our groups. So I urge you to use that method. It always works. This is 25, it's actually 40 years of political activism speaking here, because before my 25 years campaign about the genocide and all of this other stuff on the common law, I was deeply involved in political activity and on many fronts. And I made a lot of mistakes, but that's how you learn. You learn through your mistakes, through your most recent one is your best teacher, actually. And don't be afraid of looking at that. That's really what works. So in closing, urge you to go to the books, go to Amazon, put in my name, Kevin, and you'll see all of this stuff. To order any of these books in the Common Law Training Manual, The Vision of Kanata, which I talked about a few shows back, all of our programs archived at bbsradio.com/herewestand. Go there and listen to them. About 80% of you actually listen to the archive shows, so pass the word around in your own leisure time. Listen and take notes and plan what you're going to ask next time. Most importantly, use this program as your own platform. We've got people coming on who are going to be talking about the work they're doing in different parts of the country. Like I said, 43 groups now, either small numbers of individuals or organized common law assemblies that are working to take back the nation from this police state, to establish a common law republic, take back the power in our own communities. We're working on that now actively. To get information on that, write to Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, @gmail.com, thecommonland@gmail.com, and take it to heart, people. It's up to you. You are the republic. You are the resistance if you're listening to this. And a final word, I wanted to thank some of the folks in Ontario. And it's surprising because, you know, I always expected the West to act on this first. We've got 22 groups in Ontario now that are organizing, as opposed to only 5 in Alberta. Now, you Albertan folks are supposed to be, you know, the guys who are pissed off at the central government. Where are you all? Let's get going here in the West, people. And rights only exist when they're practiced. And battles are won or lost before they're ever fought, depending on who controls the essential energy, the essential narrative, the plan of action of the situation. We've shown we can outflank the system, people. We've shown how to do it. Try it yourself. It's up to you, because 10, 20, 30 years from now, when things are in a very bad shape, it's only going to be that way because you didn't act and I didn't act and all of us sat by and talked rather than acted. So this is a guide to action. We're going to end with a beautiful song, Oh Freedom, from the Civil Rights Movement. Before I die a slave, I'm going to go to my grave and go to God and be free. I love those words. We are free inside, people. We're liberated from all the fear. It's a great and glorious day every day, a great day to practice liberty. Carry it on. This is Kevin at Eagle Strong Voice back next week. Stay strong. Stay clear.
Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. Oh, freedom.
Save me.